perception of the truth. They are wrong, and so are you. I do not say this to you in anger, boy. In fact, it saddens me.
I will tell my father what you said about him, Outlander, shouted the boy. He will kill you for it.
If that is true, said Colorin softly, there will be one less person to fight the Baron's men. No, I do not think that he will. I think it more likely he will be saddened as I am that you should insult a brother at a time like this.
He's not my brother! He's the son of a whore!
That's enough!
Roared Gwalchmai, surging to his feet.
I am the Clan Dreamer, and I know the truth. Colorin has spoken it, though perhaps he should not. What festers inside you, young man, is that everyone can see the resemblance between you and Kellan. You are brothers, and no amount of harsh words will change that. You have a great deal of growing up to do. Start now!
The older boy ran from the hall, leaving the door swinging on its canvas hinges. Snow blew in, and another child moved to the door, pushing it shut and dropping the latch. The children gathered again round the two men, their faces fearful.
Sometimes, said Colorin, life can be needlessly cruel. You have witnessed such a time. Evil does not grow from the head of a devil with horns. If it did, we would all run from it. It springs from an angry word and settles in the ears of the hearers. It can grow almost unnoticed until it flowers in rage and envy, jealousy and greed. The next time you have an angry thought about a clan brother or sister, remember this.
He will kill you, you know, said the curly-haired Kellen. Jaren's father has a terrible temper. You should get a sword.
I will, should the need arise, said Colorin sadly. But now I think we should play a game and change the mood. How many here know catch the bear?
Gwalchmai quietly left the hall with the game still in progress, and the squeals and laughter of the children ringing in his ears. It was bright and cold outside, but the old man could smell the approach of distant spring upon the wind. He shivered. Colorin was right. Evil was not an external force waiting to seize upon a wandering heart. It dwelt within the heart, a cocooned maggot, waiting for the moment to break out and feed, gorging itself on the darker forces of the human soul. This was well understood by the founders of the clan, who instilled the stories and myths for youngsters to emulate. Heroes never oppressed or tormented the weak, never lied or stole, or used their powers for selfish purposes. Heroes were always subject to such dark desires, but resisted them manfully. All such stories had but one purpose, to encourage the young to battle the demons inside. Even with his talent fading, Gwalchmai knew what demons drove young Jaren. Other children whispered that Kellen was his brother. This meant that his father had been unfaithful to his mother and had then betrayed another woman, leaving her to bring up a son in shame. Jaren would not have his father slandered in such a way, and had turned his anger towards little Kellen, blaming him for the lies. His anger and his hatred were born of love for his father. Gwalchmai stood in the cold sunlight, waiting. It was not long before he saw the boy heading back with a stocky clansman beside him. For a moment he could not remember the man's name. Then it came to him. Kaz. When Gwalchmai called out to him, the man let go of his son's hand and strode towards the dreamer. His square, beardless face was pale with anger.
"You lied about me, dreamer," he said, his tone icy. "If you were a younger man, I would slay you where you stand. The Outlander is different. He will die for the honour of my family."
"And will the blood wash away the shame?"
asked Gwalchmai, holding to the man's gaze. Kaz stepped in close.
"The woman was any man's for a copper farthing. That was her work and her pleasure. I have rutted with her. Find me a man who did not."
"That is inconsequential," said Gwalchmai. "Good God, man, have you not looked at the boy? Every line of his face mirrors yours. Yet even that is beside the point.
Why should the child carry the sins of his mother? What has he done save to serve as a reminder of a night of casual coupling? And as for the Outlander, he spoke only the truth.
He called me a piece of filth, snarled Kars. Is that the truth, old man?
He did not call you anything, Kars. He was explaining to the children about how the Outlanders perceive us. Jaren became angry and took it all personally.
Enough talk,
snapped the man, drawing his claymore and turning away.
What now, Kars?
Asked Gwalchmai softly.
Will you walk into a children's gathering and slaughter the man who leads them in games? Can you not hear the laughter, the joy? How long since the clan children knew such moments?
At that instant, the doors opened and the children moved out into the light. Kars stood stock still, his sword in his hand. The laughter of the young faded away and they stood by silently, as Colorin stepped out and swung his green cloak around his slender shoulders. A small boy moved out to stand beside him. Kars looked at the child, then at his own son, Jaren. No one moved. Kars plunged his sword into the snow and stepped forward to drop on one knee before Kellen. The little boy did not flinch, but stared back at the warrior. Gwalchmai felt his heart beating erratically, his breathing shallow. For Kars to accept the boy as his own would mean a loss of honour to the proud clansman, causing grief to himself and shame to his family. To reject the evidence of his eyes would bring a different kind of shame, but one that was at least private. The warrior reached out and placed his hands on Kellen's shoulders.
You are a fine lad, he said,
his voice choked with emotion.
A fine lad. Should you wish it, you would be welcome at my fire and at my home.
Gwalchmai could scarce believe he had heard the words. Switching his gaze to Jaren, who was standing near to his father, he saw that the boy looked close to tears. Kars glanced up and called to his son, and Jaren ran to him. Kars stood, then offered his hand to Kellen.
Let us walk for a while, he said.
Kellen took his left hand, Jaren his right. Together they walked away towards the trees. Colorin strolled across to where Gwalchmai stood.
A curious encounter,
observed the younger man.
There is still nobility within the clan,
said Gwalchmai proudly,
and I will die happy.
Colorin's face showed his sorrow.
You are going back to your cabin to meet the soldiers who will kill you. Why? You know that if you stay here, you will thwart them.
Aye, agreed Gwalchmai.
There are magical moments when a man can change the future, but not this time. I still have one small task to perform, one last gift for Sigarni. You will plant a seed,
said Colorin sadly,
and you will die for it. Take care of my dogs, young man. I've grown to love them, and now I must go.
Suddenly Gwalchmai chuckled.
There are two jugs of honeymead liquor hidden in my loft back home. I can hear them calling to me.
Colorin put out his hand.
You are a good man, Gwalchmai, and a brave one. I know you are concerned about Sigarni, and how she will fare without your guidance. I will be her gifted one, and I will never betray her. There is one who will,
said the old man.
I do not know who. I will watch for him,
promised Colorin.
Leofric's servant banked up the fire and brought in fresh candles, which he lit and placed atop the dying stubs. The blonde-haired young man did not acknowledge his presence, but remained poring over maps and calculations. Leofric was not a happy man. Much as he enjoyed the logistics of a campaign, he could not divorce himself from the feeling that it was all so unnecessary. The clans had been peaceful for years. And now the Baron was set to bring fire and death into their lands. And for what? A little glory and the chance to rise again in the king's eyes. That, and the speculation on land prices south of the border. It was all so meaningless. The servant placed a goblet of steaming tisane before him. Leofric lifted it and sipped the brew, which was sweet and spiced with liquor.
"Thank you. Most thoughtful,"
he said, looking up at the servant. The man disappeared from his mind instantly. The army would march in 10 weeks. Each of the 6,000 men would carry 4 days' food supply with them. Leofric lifted a quill pen. 1 pound of oats, 8 ounces of dried beef, 1/2 ounce of salt. 7 pennies for each pack, multiplied by 6,000. He shook his head. The Baron would not be pleased at such an outlay. Sipping his tisane, he leaned back in his chair. By his reckoning, this war would cost 12,400 gold pieces in wages, food, and materials. But the Baron had budgeted for 10,000. Where to make cuts? Salt was expensive, but soldiers would not march without it. And it was common knowledge that an absence of beef in the diet led to cowardly behaviour. But halving the oats ration would mean less bulk food. And besides would save only... He scribbled down a calculation, then multiplied it. 342 gold pieces. Then he brightened.
"You have not considered the dead," he thought. "The Highlanders will fight, and that means a percentage of the army would not be requiring food or payment."
But how many? On a normal campaign with the Baron, the losses could be as high as 30%, but that would not be the situation here. Half that? A quarter? Say 5%. 300 men. Once more he bent over his calculations.
"Almost there," he decided.
The servant returned. "Begging your pardon, my lord, but there is a man to see you."
"What time is it?"
"A little before midnight, sir."
"An odd time to be calling. Who is it?"
"I do not know him, sir. He's a stranger. He asked for you and said he had information you would find invaluable." Leofric sighed. He was tired.
"Very well, show him in. Give us no more than 10 minutes, then interrupt me on a matter of importance. You understand?"
"Of course, sir." The man bowed and departed. Leofric rubbed his eyes and yawned.
"Midnight, dear God, I've been working on these papers for 7 hours.
Hastily he gathered them together, pushing them into a drawer. The servant returned, ushering in a middle-aged man with a round, fleshy face and glittering eyes.
"I trust you will forgive this intrusion," said the newcomer, "but the news I have could not wait for the morning." "And why is that, pray?"
countered Leofric, gesturing the man to a seat.
"You were working on the invasion plans," said the other with a smile. "My information will force substantial changes." "How do you know what I was working on?" "Let us come back to that, Leofric," said the man with a wide smile. "For now, let me tell you that 2 of your 3 forts have fallen to the clansmen, and all the supplies they contain are now being consumed by your enemies."
Leofric's weariness vanished immediately.
"That's not possible. I supervised the structures myself. They were impregnable."
"Not from deceit, it appears."
Leofric sat down.
"Deceit?"
"The woman, Sigani, sent the traitor Oberyn and 100 men posing as a relief force. Both forts are rendered without a fight."
"How? Who are you?"
"I think you can fairly assume that I am a friend, Lord Leofric. I also have information concerning Sigani and her plans. She is gathering an army, you know."
"Under whose leadership?"
"Her own, of course. She is of the Blood Royal, and she masterminded the defeat of your forces at Kilfallan. Fine credentials, don't you think?"
"How many men does she command now?"
"Close to 2,000. The Fallen are with her, and the Palides will soon follow. Unless she is stopped, that is."
"We cannot get through until the thaw. All the northern passes are blocked."
"You cannot get through, but I can. I have already, in a manner of speaking."
The servant entered.
"My lord, I think you should..."
"Yes, yes, no need for that now. Bring me another tisane and one for our guest."
The man nodded and bowed as Leofric returned his attention to his guest.
"I think it is time you declared your interest in this matter," he said.
"Of course. I am hunting the witch Sigourney. My reasons are of no concern to you, but it is important to me that I find her. Surrounded as she is now by loyal clansmen, it might be difficult for me to reach her. You can help me in my quest, as I can help you in yours."
"You are a magicka,"
the man laughed. "Nothing so dainty, my lord. I am a sorcerer. Some time ago I was paid to remove the problem Sigourney posed. I failed 3 times. I say this without shame, for my opponents were mighty indeed. Happily, they now believe me to be dead, which leaves me free to enjoy the success I have waited for."
"Why would they think you're dead?"
"A man was torn to pieces by demons. I made sure he resembled me in every way. You wish to hear more?"
Leofric shook his head.
"Absolutely not. What is it you require of me in return for your information?"
"I find that I am short of funds in Citadel Town. I am far from my own bankers and would be grateful for a gratuity that would enable me to rent a house in Citadel. There's much I must do to prepare for my next attempt. Men and materials, that sort of thing."
"Of course. Where are you staying at present?"
"A hostelry nearby, the Blue Duck Tavern."
"I will have one of my servants bring you money tomorrow morning. I would also appreciate any further information you can supply concerning the plans of the rebels."
The man rubbed his fleshy chin.
"I will consider that," he said. "It is a delicate business. You see, I don't want you to capture or kill Sigourney. That delight is for me. I'll think on it and let you know my decision."
"The Baron will almost certainly want to see you."
"I don't believe so, Lord Leofric. Tell him you have a spy who brought you this information. That, after all, is the truth. Do not mention me to him. It would displease me."
"Who shall my servant ask for tomorrow?"
Leofric inquired. "Oh, I am sorry. I did not introduce myself. My name is Jakuta Khan."
Balistar's hatred for winter was deep and perfect, for it was the one season designed to highlight his deformity. His short, stumpy legs could not cope with deep snow, and he felt a prisoner in Asmodeus' house. Balistar longed to be with Sigourney again, planning for the spring and the coming war.
"You would be useless now,"
he said aloud, as he perched on the battlements, staring out over the winter landscape.
"Useless."
Scrambling to his feet, he stood. Yet today there was no enjoyment in being so high. It served only to emphasize how tiny he was. Snow began to fall as Balistar dropped to his belly and lowered himself to the parapet. Back inside his upper room, he stoked the fire and sat down on the rug, staring into the flames. The chairs were all too tall, and Ari had brought a wooden box to the room so that Balistar could climb into bed.
"Why was I born like this?" he wondered. "What sin could a child be guilty of that a vengeful god could condemn into a life such as this?"
No one understood his torment. How could they? Even Sigourney had once said, "Perhaps one day you will meet a beautiful dwarf woman and be happy."
"I don't want a dwarf woman," he thought. "Just because I am deformed, it doesn't mean I will find deformity attractive in others. I want you, Sigourney. I want you to love me, to see me as a man. It won't happen."
He remembered the taunts that marked his childhood and adolescence. Bacchus Toothgon had once caused great merriment with a joke about Balistar and his inability to find love.
"How could he make love to a woman?"
Bacchus had said. "If they were nose to nose, he'd have his toes in it. Toes to toes, he'd have his nose in it. And if he ever got there, he'd have no one to talk to." Oh, yes. Great roars of laughter had greeted the jest. Even Balistar had chuckled. What other choice was there? Balistar left his room and wandered downstairs and out into the stable yard. The little white pony was in her stall, and the dwarf climbed to the rail by her head and stroked her neck. The pony swung her head and nuzzled him.
"Do you worry about being a dwarf horse?"
he said.
You look at the tall mares with envy. The pony returned to munching the straw in her feed box. It was cold in the stable, and Ballistar saw that the pony's blanket had slipped from her back. Climbing to the floor, he retrieved it and tried to flip it back into place. It was a large blanket, and as he tried to throw it high, it fell back over Ballistar's head. Three times he tried. On the last, it was almost in place, but the pony moved to its right and the blanket fell to the left. It was the final humiliation for Ballistar. Tears welled in his dark eyes, and he thought again of the high parapet. On the north side, at the base of the wall, there were sharp rocks. If I were to throw myself from the battlements, I would die, he thought. No more pain, no more humiliation. Ballistar returned to the house and began to climb the stairs. The servant warrior, Ari, moved out of the library and saw him.
Good morning, Ballistar.
Good morning, mumbled the dwarf, continuing his climb. I was wondering if you could assist me. Ballistar hesitated and glanced down through the stair rails at the tall black man.
Not today, he said.
It is important, said Ari softly.
I am studying the maps of the Dwan Pass, for that is where we believe the first battle will be fought.
Do you know it?
I know it.
Good. Then you will be of great assistance. Ari turned away and re-entered the library. Ballistar stood for a moment, then slowly climbed down the stairs and followed the man. Ari was sitting on the floor with maps all around him. A coal fire was burning in the hearth. Ballistar slumped down beside the man.
What do you need?
He asked. These woods here, said Ari, pointing to a green section. Are they thick and dense, or light and open?
Reasonably light, furs mostly. You thought to hide men there.
It was a possibility. Ballistar shook his head.
Not possible. But there is a gully just behind the woods where a force could be concealed.
There, he said, stabbing his index finger on the map.
No, I will leave you.
Ah, but we have just begun, said Ari with a smile. Look at this.
He passed Ballistar a sketch, and the dwarf took it. Upon it was an outline of Dwan Pass, and a series of rectangles, some blacked in, others in various colours.
What are these?
The classic outland battle formation. Infantry at the centre, the heavy black blocks, two divisions. The blue represents the cavalry, the yellow, archers and slingers. The cavalry also may be in two divisions, lightly armoured and heavily armoured. But this we do not yet know.
Where would you place our forces?
I'm not a soldier,
snapped Ballistar.
Indeed not. But you are a bright, intelligent man. Skills can be learned.
Let me give you an example. Where would cavalry be of limited use?
In a forest, answered Ballistar, where the trees and undergrowth would restrict a mounted man. And what slows down infantry?
Hills, mountains, rivers,
forests again.
There, you see, Ari told him.
Having established that, then we look for ways to ensure that battles are fought where we desire them, in forests, on hills.
So where, in Dwan, would you position our forces?
Ballistar gazed at the map.
There is only one good defensive point. There is a flat-topped hill at the northern end of the pass, but it would be surrounded swiftly.
Yes, said Ari, it would.
How many people could gather there?
I don't know. 1,000?
I would think 2,000, said Ari,
which is our entire force.
What would be the point of such an action? Asked Ballistar.
Once surrounded, there would be no way to retreat, and even the advantage of occupying a hill would be overcome by an outland army numbering more than 5,000 men.
Yet it remains the only true defensive position, insisted Ari.
Once the outlanders are through Dwan Pass, they can spread out and attack isolated hamlets and villages. Nothing could stop them.
I don't know the answer,
Ballistar admitted.
Nor I. But we will speak of it again. tonight at dinner. He looked directly into Ballistar's eyes.
Or did you have other plans?
Ballistar took a deep breath.
No. No other plans.
That is good.
I will see you later. You really believe I can be of help in this?
Asked Ballistar, struggling to his feet.
Of course. Take these sketches with you, and think about them.
Ballistar smiled.
I will, Ari. Thank you.
The black man shrugged and returned to his studies.
Chapter 11.
By God, she's some woman, said Oberyn, peeling off his jerkin and sitting by the fire.
They fell just like she said they would, like skittles. I could scarce believe it fell. When I rode up to that Farlam fort, my heart was in my mouth. The officer just ordered the gates open, listened to my report, then turned over command to me and rode out. What a moment! I even told him the best route through the snow, and he rode his men into Graham's trap.
Graham lost no men in that first encounter, yet more than 20 when the Palladies detachment was ambushed, said Fell.
That's nothing compared with the 200 we slew in those engagements,
pointed out Oberyn.
It's a damn shame the men from the loader fort escaped.
I still don't know what went wrong there.
They simply got lost,
said Fell,
and missed the trap. No one's fault.
Oberyn reached for a pottery jug and pulled the cork.
The Baron's wine,
he said with a dry chuckle.
There were 6 jugs in each fort. It's a good vintage. Try some.
Fell shook his head.
I think I'll take a walk,
he said.
What's wrong, Fell? Nothing. I just need to walk.
Oberyn replaced the cork and looked hard at the handsome forester.
I'm not the most intuitive of men, Fell, but I've been a sergeant for 12 years, and I know when something is eating at a man.
What is it?
Fear. Apprehension.
Fell smiled wearily.
Is it so obvious, then? It is to me. That your men must not see it. That is one of the secrets of leadership, Fell. Your confidence becomes their confidence. They feed off you like wolf cubs suckling at their mother's teat. If you despair, they despair.
Fell chuckled.
I've never been compared with a mother wolf before. Pass the jug.
He took several long swallows.
You're right,
he said, wiping his lips with the back of his hand.
The wine is good. But I don't fear the outlanders, Oberyn. I'm not afraid to die for my people. What gnaws at me is more personal. I shall make sure that my feelings do not show as strongly in the future.
Sigarni, said Oberyn, lifting the jug.
How would you know that?
Asked Fell, surprised. Oberyn grinned.
Oh, listen, Fell. It's another secret of leadership. You were lovers, but now you are not.
Don't let it concern you. You're a good-looking lad, and there are plenty of women who'd love to warm your bed. Fell shook his head.
That's not the whole reason for my sadness. You didn't know her when she was just the Huntress. God, man, she was a wonder. Strong and fearless, but more than that, she had a love for life and a laugh that was magical. She can make a cold day of drizzle and grey sky suddenly seem beautiful. She was a woman. What is she now? Have you ever seen her laugh or even smile at a jest? Sweet heaven, she's become a creature of ice, a winter queen.
Fell drank again, long and deeply.
There's not been a great deal to laugh about, observed Oberyn. But I hear what you say.
I once owned a crystal sphere. There was a rose set inside as if trapped in ice.
I've always loved roses, and this was one of the most beautiful blooms, rich and velvet red. It would live forever, yet it had no scent and would not seed. That is it, said Fell. Exactly that, like the crown of Alwyn. All men can see it, none can touch it.
Oberyn smiled.
I've often heard Highlanders talk of the lost crown. Is it a myth?
Fell shook his head.
I saw it when I was 10.
It appears once every 25 years at the center of the pool at Ironhands Falls. It's beautiful, man. It is more a helmet than a crown, and the silver shines like captured moonlight. There are silver wings, flat against the helm like those of a hawk when it dives, and a gold band around the brow inscribed with ancient runes. It has a nasal guard, like an Outland helm, and this is also silver, as are the cheek guards. I was there with my father. It was the winter before he went down with the plague. My last winter with him. He took me to the falls, and we stood there with the gathered clans. I could not see at first, and he lifted me to his shoulders. A man cursed behind us, but then the crown appeared. It shimmered for maybe 10, 12 heartbeats. Then it was gone. Man, what a night.
Sounds like a conjuring trick to me,
said Oberyn.
I've seen magic is make birds of gold that fly high into the air and explode in showers of coloured sparks.
It was no trick,
said Fel, without a hint of anger. Alwyn was Ironhand's uncle. He had no children, and he hated Ironhand. When he was dying, he ordered one of his wizards to hide the crown where Ironhand would never find it, thus condemning his nephew to a reign fraught with civil war and insurrection. Without it, Ironhand was a king with no credentials. You understand?
It makes no sense to me,
said Oberyn. He had a right of blood. Why did he need a piece of metal? The crown had magical properties. Only a true king could wear it. It was not made by Alwyn's order. It was far older. Once when a usurper killed the king and placed the crown on his head, his skin turned black and fire erupted from his eyes. He melted away like snow in the sunshine.
Muttered Oberyn, unconvinced. 'Tis a pretty tale. My tribe has many such. The spear of Goldark, the sword of Calthin. Maybe one day I'll see this crown.
But you were talking of Sigourney. If you loved her and she you, why did it end?
I was a fool. I wanted sons, Oberyn. It's important in the Highlands. I had a need to watch my boys grow, to teach them of forestry and hunting, to instill in them a love of the land.
Sigourney is barren, like your rose in crystal. I walked away from her. But not an hour has passed since when her face does not shine in my memories. Even when I lay with my wife Gwen, all I could see was Sigourney. It was the worst mistake of my life.
Fel drained the last of the wine and lay back on the floor of the hut.
I'd just like to see her laugh once more. Maybe the way she was.
He closed his eyes. Oberyn sat quietly as Fel's breathing deepened.
You're wrong, Fel, he thought. I know what war is, and I know the pain and terror that is coming. Given a choice, I'd keep Sigourney the way she is, the Ice Queen, a cold-hearted warrior woman whose strategies have already seen 3 enemy forts overcome and several tons of supplies brought into the encampments.
Oberyn pulled on his jerkin and stepped out into the night. Sigourney was tired. The morning had been a long one, discussing supplies with Tovey, organizing patrols with Graham and Fel, then poring over the battle plans drawn up by Asmodeer and Ari, listening to Oberyn's tales of woe concerning training.
"We've not the time to train them properly," said the stocky outlander. "I've got them responding to the hunting horn for attack and retreat and reform, but that is it. Your army will be like a spear, Sigourney. One throw is all you get."
She felt as if her mind could not take one more ounce of pressure, and had walked with Lady to a hilltop to look upon the ageless beauty of Hydruin, hoping to steal a fragment of its eternal peace. 2 of Asmodeus Al-Ja'in walked 20 paces behind her, never speaking but always present. At first their ceaseless vigilance had been a source of irritation, but now she found their silent presence reassuring. A stand of trees grew across the hilltop, and these gave some shelter from the wind as Sigourney stared out over the winter landscape at the brooding magnificence of High Druin, its sharp peaks spearing the clouds. Down on the slopes leading to the valley, she could see Loda children tobogganing and hear the squeals of their laughter. The sounds were shrill and echoed in the mountains.
Will they still be laughing in a few weeks? She wondered.
Taliesin had disappeared again, gone to whatever secret place wizards inhabit, and his last words to her echoed constantly in her memory.
The Palades will ask for a sign.
They already have,
she had told him.
No, no, listen to me. They will ask for something specific. When they do, agree to it. Don't hesitate. I will be back when I have prepared the way. Will you trust me?
You have given me no reason to distrust you. But what if they ask me to supply the moon on a silver salver?
Say that you will,
he said, with a dry laugh. He threw his tattered cloak of feathers around his scrawny frame, and his smile faded.
They will not ask that, but it will seem as difficult. Remember my word, Sigourney. I will be back before the first snowdrops of spring. We will meet by Iron Hands Falls in 12 days.
Lady brushed against her leg and whined. Sigourney knelt and stroked her long ears.
I've neglected you, my lovely, she said. I am sorry.
Lady's long nose pushed against Sigourney's cheek, and she felt the hound's warm tongue on her face.
You are so forgiving.
She patted Lady's dark flank.
She wishes solitude,
she heard one of her guards say. Sigourney turned to see a tall, dark-haired woman standing with the two men.
Let her through, she called.
The woman gave the black mare a wide berth and walked up the hillside. She was thin of face with a prominent nose, but her large brown eyes gave her face a semblance of beauty.
You wish to speak with me? Said Sigourney.
I do. I am Laelia, the wife of Torgon.
There is no place for him among my officers, said Sigourney sternly. He is a fool.
That is a trait shared by most men I have met, said Laelia. But then, war is a foolish game.
Have you come to plead for him?
No. He will regain his honor, or he will not. That is for him. I came to speak with you. I have questions.
Sigourney removed her cloak and spread it over the snow.
Come, sit with me. Why not more questions? That is my life now, endless questions, each with 100 answers.
You look tired, said Laelia. You should rest more.
I will when there is time. Now ask your questions.
The dark-haired woman was silent for a moment, staring deeply into Sigourney's pale blue eyes.
What if we win?
She asked at last.
Sigourney laughed. If we lose, we die. That is all I know. My God, I certainly have no time to think of the aftermath of a victory that is by no means certain.
I think you should, said Laelia softly. If you don't, then you are just like a man, never seeing beyond the end of your nose.
Sigourney sighed.
You are correct. I am tired. So let us assume the hair is bagged and move on to the cooking. What do you want?
Laelia chuckled.
I have heard a lot about you, Sigourney. You've lived a life many women, myself included, would envy. But I don't envy you now, trying to adjust to a world of men.
I ask about victory for a simple, selfish reason.
I have children, and I want those children to grow in the Highland way, with their father beside them, learning about cattle and crops, family, clan, and honor. The Outlanders threaten our way of life, not just by their invasion, but by our resistance.
Tell me this. If you beat the Baron, what then? Is it over?
No, admitted Sigourney. They will send another army.
And how will you combat them?
In whatever way I can, said Sigourney guardedly.
You will be forced to attack the lowland cities, sack their treasuries and hire mercenaries.
Sigourney smiled grimly.
Perhaps. And if you defeat the next army, will that end the war?
I don't know, snapped Sigourney, but I doubt it. Where is this leading?
It seems to me, said Laelia sadly, that win or lose, our way of life is finished. The war will go on and on. The more you win, the further away you will take our men, perhaps all the way to the Outland capital. What then, when the outlying armies of their empire gather? Will you be fighting in Kushir in 10 years?
If I am, it will not be from choice, Sigourney told her. I hear you, Laelia, and I understand what you're saying. If there is a way I can avoid what you fear, then I will. You have my word on that.
The dark-haired woman smiled and laid her hand on Sigourney's arm. I believe you. You know, I have always thought the world would be a better place with women as leaders. We wouldn't fight stupid wars over worthless pieces of land. We would talk to one another and reach compromises that would suit both factions. I know that you have to be a war leader, Sigourney, but I ask that you be a woman leader and not just a pretend man in armor.
You're very forthright, Laelia. A shame you're not so forthright with Torgon.
I did my best, said the other with a wry smile, but he was not gifted with a good brain. He is, however, a fine partner in bed, so I will not complain too much.
Sigourney's laughter rang out. I'm glad he's good at something.
He's also a good father, said Laelia. The children adore him, and he plays with them constantly.
I am sorry, said Sigourney. I've obviously not seen the best of him. Have you been married long?
14 years come summer. She smiled. He hasn't changed much in those years, save to lose some of his hair. It's beautiful here, isn't it? The sun gleaming on Hydruin.
Yes,
Sigourney agreed. Laelia rose. I've taken too much of your time. I will leave you to your thoughts. Sigourney stood.
Thank you, Laelia. I feel refreshed, though I don't know why.
You've spent too long in the company of men, said Laelia. Perhaps we should talk again.
I would enjoy that.
Laelia stepped forward and embraced the silver-haired warrior woman, kissing her on both cheeks. Sigourney felt hot tears spill to her face. Abruptly, she pulled clear and turned back towards Hydruin.
You shouldn't have brought me, grumbled Balistar. I'm slowing you down.
That's true, grunted Sigourney as they faced yet another deep snowdrift. But you're such good company.
Balistar shifted on her shoulders.
Put me down, and we'll see if we can crawl along the top of it. There should be solid ground about 30 feet ahead. Then it's just one more hill to the falls.
Sigourney swiveled and tipped the little man from her shoulders. He fell headfirst into the drift and came up spluttering and spitting snow.
You are heavy for a small man, she said, laughing.
And you have the boniest shoulders I ever sat upon, he told her, brushing snow from his beard.
Turning to his stomach, Balistar began to squirm across the snow. Sigourney followed him, using her arms to force a path. After an hour of effort, they reached solid ground and sat for a while, gathering their strength.
I'm freezing to death, muttered Balistar. I hope you've left enough firewood in the cave. I'm in no mood to go gathering.
Enough for a couple of hours, she assured him. The falls were still frozen at the center, but at the sides, water had begun to trickle through the ice.
The thaw is coming,
said the dwarf. I know, said Sigourney softly.
Inside the cave, Sigourney started a fire, and they shrugged out of their soaked outer clothing.
So, why did you bring me?
Asked Balistar.
I thought you'd enjoy my company, she told him.
That's not very convincing.
She looked at him, and remembered how out of place he had seemed back at the encampment, how lonely and sad.
I wanted company, she said, and I could think of no one else I would rather have with me.
He blushed and looked away.
I'll accept that,
he said brightly.
Do you remember when we used to play here as children? You, me, Fel and Bernd built a treehouse. It fell apart in the big storm. Fel was climbing and the floor gave way, you remember?
Tsigani nodded.
Bernd stole the nails from Graham. More nails in that structure than wood. It was fun, wasn't it? Fun? You were always arguing with the others, getting into scrapes and fights.
I know, he said. I was young then, and not growing like the rest of you. But I look back on those times as the happiest of my life. Do you think the others would?
Bernd no longer looks back, she said, her voice almost a whisper.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sigourney. I wasn't thinking.
Reaching out, he took her slender hand in his own, his stubby fingers caressing her wrist.
It wasn't your fault. Not really. I think if you had gone, he would still have killed himself had you turned him down. It was his life. He chose to take it.
Tsigani shook her head.
I don't think that is the whole truth. Had I known the outcome beforehand, I would have acted differently. But now I think about how I was lying in bed with Asmodeir, enjoying myself utterly. She sighed. And while I was being pleasured, Bernd was tying a rope around his neck.
Ballistar looked away and fiddled with the fire, poking small sticks into the flames.
Now I have embarrassed you, she said.
Yes, you have, he told her, reddening. But we're friends, Sigourney. We always will be. I don't want you to feel there are words you cannot say in my presence.
But when is the wizard due? He asked, changing the subject.
Tomorrow.
I wish she'd chosen a more hospitable meeting place.
It had to be here, she said. He knew what the Pallades would ask of me.
Madness, snapped Ballistar. Who do they think they are? Here we sit on the verge of war and they play games. Do they believe they can win without us?
No, my friend, they don't think that. Their dreamers have told them that the leader will wear the crown of Ulwyn. If that is true, then I must find it. Taliesin will have a plan.
I don't like wizards,
said the dwarf.
I remember you saying that about Asmodeir.
A black sorcerer,
you called him.
I still don't like him. Are you still lovers?
No.
Her voice was sharper than she intended, and Ballistar gazed at her quizzically.
Did he wrong you?
She shook her head. I don't want to talk about it.
I want your help before dusk. I want you to come with me to the far side of the pool and break the ice.
Why?
He asked, mystified. I need to swim.
That's ridiculous. The cold will kill you.
You can wait for me with a blanket, she said.
There's something you are not telling me. What are you looking for?
Tsigani stretched out her hand to the fire. The cave was glowing now in the firelight, and the sounds of winter outside only served to make it seem more cozy within.
I'm going to find a small bone, she said. A talisman, if you like. A good luck charm.
Whose bones?
He asked, wide-eyed.
Ironhand.
Ballistar's jaw dropped.
You found his bones? He didn't pass over the gateway?
No. He died here, fighting his enemies.
How will a bone help you?
Enough questions, Bally. Come on. We're warm enough now.
Together they left the cave and trudged across the snow-covered ice of the pool. Tsigani found the boulder under which the bones lay, and she and Ballistar began to chip away at the surrounding ice with their knives. It was slow work, and Ballistar lost his patience. Climbing to the top of the jutting boulder, he jumped to the ice, landing hard. Four times more he did so. Then on the fifth, a large crack appeared.
Almost there, he said.
Suddenly, the ice gave, and he fell through into the dark waters beneath. Tsigani dived across the ice, her hand snaking out to grab his collar just as he was about to sink. With a great effort, she hauled him back.
You'd better get to the cave, she said.
No, I'm all right, he said, shivering.
Can you reach the bones from here?
I don't know. I'll have to be fast.
Slipping out of her clothes, she slithered into the water.
Be careful. There's an undertow,
warned Ballister. The cold chilled her to the bone, and all was darkness. Holding to the boulder, she released some air and dived deeper. Her hand touched the bottom and she scrabbled around, but could feel nothing but stones. Something sharp cut the palm of her hand. The sudden shock caused her to breathe out, and her lungs aching, she rose towards the surface. Her head thumped against ice. She had missed the opening. Holding down panic, she rolled to her back, pushing her face towards the ice. There was always a tiny gap between ice and water, and she breathed in deeply. The cold was bitter now, and she could not feel her fingers.
"You stupid woman," she thought, "to come so far and die so stupidly."
A faint glow surrounded her.
"Why do you never call for me, child?"
asked Ironhand.
"Dive to the bottom and collect what you came for, then follow me to the surface."
Filling her lungs with air, she rolled and dived, kicking out against the ice to propel herself down. In the glow, she saw Ironhand sitting on the pool floor. Beside him was a human head, but she did not recognize the face. On the other side of the ghostly giant lay his bones. Swiftly, she grabbed a finger bone and rose towards the surface. As she broke clear, Ballister took hold of her arm and dragged her onto the ice.
"I was worried near to death," complained the dwarf.
Tsigane could not speak. She had begun to shake uncontrollably.
"And look, you've cut your hand," he said,
pointing to the trickle of blood on her palm. Ballister took up her clothes and led her back to the cave, where she sat wrapped in a blanket, her face and hands blue.
"I hope that bone was worth it," he said.
"It was," she told him. "He is here."
"Who is?"
"Ironhand."
"Ironhand," he repeated. "In the cave? With us?"
Ballister gazed around fearfully.
"I don't see him."
Tsigane shrugged off the blanket and moved a little way from the fire.
"Come and rub my skin," she said.
Ballister put his hands on her shoulders and began to massage the flesh.
"So now we are dealing with wizards and ghosts," he said.
"Lower, on my back," she ordered.
Ballister knelt behind her and rubbed gently at the cold skin.
"You should sit closer to the fire."
"No, it would do more harm than good. When I am a little warmer. Oh, that is nice. Now my arms."
He sat beside her, kneading her flesh, encouraging the blood to flow. He tried not to stare at her breasts, but failed. Tsigane did not seem to notice.
"Of course she doesn't," he thought. "I am not a man to her."
"I am going to sleep now, Bali. Watch over me and keep the fire going."
Holding fast to the bone, she lay down by the fire. Ballister covered her with two blankets. As she closed her eyes, he leaned down and kissed her cheek.
"What was that for?"
she asked sleepily.
"Love you,"
he said.
"Oh, I love you too,"
she whispered, and slept. The fire burned low, and Ballister added the last of the wood. Tsigane's flesh was still cool, and the dwarf wandered out into the cold of the night to gather dead wood. The carcasses of the demons still lay where Tsigane had slain them, but they were not rotting. It was too cold for that.
"They'll smell bad come spring,"
thought Ballister as he wandered beneath the trees, kicking at the snow and seeking fuel.
"Over there,"
said a voice.
"Beneath the oaks."
Ballister leapt, turned and fell over. Standing beside him was a glowing figure in ancient armour, his white beard braided into forks. He wore a long, double-handed broadsword in a scabbard of embossed silver, and the hand resting on it was made of red iron.
"By heaven, you are Scottish," said the ghost. "Are you going to fetch the wood or not?"
"Yes, lord," answered Ballister.
"I am not your lord, dwarf. I am merely a spirit. Now fetch the wood before she freezes to death."
Ballistar nodded and dug around in the snow beneath the oaks, gathering dead wood, then returning to the cave. The glowing figure stayed by him, watching his efforts.
"It cannot be easy to live in such a body,"
he said.
"A choice would be pleasant," muttered Ballistar.
"You've a handsome face, lad. Be thankful for small gifts."
"All my gifts are small, bar one, and I'll never get to use that," answered Ballistar, kneeling by the fire and placing two long sticks upon it.
The ghost assumed a sitting position by the fire.
"You can never be sure,"
he said.
"I had two dwarfs at my court, and they were always in demand. Once I had to adjudicate in a very delicate matter, where a knight cited one of my dwarfs as his wife's secret lover. He wanted the dwarf hanged and his wife burned at the stake."
"What did you do? Did you kill them?"
"Do I look like a barbarian? I told the knight that he would be laughed out of the kingdom if he sought a public trial. The wife was sent back to her family in disgrace. I have the dwarf castrated. However, that's not the point. Never lose faith, little man."
"Well, thank you for your advice," snapped Ballistar.
"However, I've not yet met a woman who would wish to have me clamber all over her."
He told the spirit of Bacchris' jest, and Ironhand laughed.
"Nose to nose, yes, that's very good. How did you respond?"
"I laughed with them, though it broke my heart."
"Aye, it's the way."
He leaned forward, peering at Sigourney.
"Is she warming up?"
he asked. Ballistar moved alongside the sleeping woman and touched the flesh of her arm.
"A little. She was seeking your bones. Damn near died for it." "I know. I was there. Willful child."
The ghost smiled.
"She can't help it. It is in her blood. I was willful myself. How is the war progressing?"
"I would have thought you'd know more about that than a mere dwarf," said Ballistar. "Can spirits not fly around the world?"
"I don't know any spirits," said Ironhand, "but I cannot. I'm trapped here, where I died. Well, until now. Wherever Sigourney goes, I shall go too."
"That's a comforting thought. I think you'll cause a certain amount of panic back at the encampment."
Ironhand shook his head.
"No one will see me, boy. Not even you. I only showed myself to you since Sigourney was foolish enough to tell you about me. So, what is happening?"
Ballistar told the king of the Pallades' request that Sigourney should find the lost crown.
"We are waiting for Taliesin," he concluded. "You'll show us where it is."
"Oh, I know where it is," said Ironhand. "That won't be the problem. Getting there and out again alive is the issue."
"Where is it?"
"In a dying world of sorcery, a dark, malevolent place. Even the air is poisonous with magic. No true man can live there for more than a few months. You would sicken and die. One of my wizards tracked it down and passed through a gateway to retrieve it. We never saw him again. A second followed him. He came back broken and diseased. Not all our medicines and charms could heal him. But while he lived, he told us of the world, its beasts and its wars. I decided then to send no more of my people in search of the crown."
"But Sigourney must go there," said Ballistar. "Without the crown, the Pallades will not accept our leadership. They might believe you, though. You could appear to Fionn Sharpax and tell him Sigourney is the chosen one."
The ghost shook his head.
"It might work, but then Sigourney would rule only through a long-dead king. No, Ballistar. She must win the right for herself. When my wizard returned, he told me the crown was in a temple, at the center of a city at war. He saw it, was even allowed to touch it. I think he believed that to do so would heal him of his afflictions in that world. It didn't."
"You say, allowed to touch it? There are people there."
"Aye, there are people. They cling to life in a world of death."
"What is killing them?"
"There is no sun to bring life to the land. The city was built inside a forest of dead trees. There is no grass and no crops grow. The land is in perpetual twilight. The mountains there spew fire and ash,
and occasionally rip themselves apart with sounds like a thousand thunders. You can see why I forbade any further ventures into that land. But without cattle and crops, how do they survive? Asked Ballister.